Are we being taped? Let's see now, what I say to, Jimmy's out of the closet here, what I say to that is bullshit. No, and the reason I say that is that you ask him about Oaklawn Park and how is a mile race won at Oaklawn Park, and he'll tell you exactly how it's run. And if that isn't a model, I don't know what it is. They're won by sprinters sprinting to the first call and winning, aren't they? All right, and is that a model or isn't it? It is. Now, he walks around with it in his head.
He don't write it down, though.
That's right. And he does understand the pace characteristics of these racetracks. And he's right. The matchup does supersede it quite often. When you have the right mix of front runners or closers, that will supersede the model. That's why anybody that keeps one will say, you know, I always have one race a day or two races a day that upset that. Well, that's logical. That's the way racing is. But Jimmy understands what's going on. I mean, you ask him about Oaklawn Park, he told me how to play it. Now, if that's not a model, God knows what is.
I am. My model is very similar to both of them. I save my pictures. I save my stop action pre-play pictures. And even if I don't save them, in fact, I have them ingrained in my mind. I can tell you how any track that I've ever played is going to play at any given day. Just from experience and just from looking at the past performance. I love opening day at Del Mar because I know that all the sharp handicappers are going to be betting early front runners, and I know they're not going to win, and I'm going to win, get double-digit mutuals for about the first 2 weeks until somebody finally gets it through their head that Del Mar doesn't play. And it's the same when you go from Belmont to Aqueduct and back and forth anywhere. It's a keeping a model. Whether you keep it in your head or you keep it on paper is secondary. So both of these guys keep models. Jimmy's got the best model in the world. He can tell me anything I want to know about any track that he plays. And he does it by doing it, like by knowing from experience. And we also know this, and this is very important. If your model says the track is running other than early, don't say it's running sustained, other than early, or it's running early, you have to know what the parameters are. You have to know how sustained a horse can be to overturn the early so-called bias, and how much an early horse can overturn a sustained bias. We had a little early horse paid $48 at Del Mar. It was so early, it was also sustained, but it was so early, it had damn near finished the race when the rest of them reached the stretch. So you have to know what will overturn this alleged model, if you want to call it that. So I'm in agreement with both of them. I'll go and play either one of their selections if I didn't get a good night's sleep, which this might be, today might be the day. Any questions on that, you should really get with the guys if you don't understand that. Because it is, how many of you, just show of hands, how many of you when you go to play a track, watch the previous, get there in time to watch the previous day's replays? Then you know what I'm talking about. That's the secret. Sit there and just, never mind if you don't want to look at the beginning, start looking when they start coming to the turns, the far turn. Start looking and identify those little numbers they put there, real helpful. Identify where they are. And then identify which numbers come on and which numbers hold back. If you want to really determine something, when they hit the first quarter mile, write down the first four numbers that you see on the screen when they hit the quarter mile after the start. Now, when those horses come home, start crossing out the ones that aren't still there, and it's all four of them, you've got a good hint that they're not going wire to wire, folks. So most of this can be answered if you will just use your head. Just use your powers of observation. This is the kind of question I like. This is a guy who snapped his rubber band. Hey, guys, what winnings do you recommend reporting to the IRS? All the way.
I report every nickel I make at the racetrack to the IRS.
And I know why, too.
Nobody gets an answer on that question. I mean, I know it's in good faith, but you don't get an answer on it.
In all seriousness, your government is going to give you and it's going to give people your money, and if you don't have any, they'll give you theirs. So we've got to have to support them, because they're going to support everybody.
When you have to sign up, that's one thing. That's what you report. I mean, that's what I report when I have to sign up.
Okay, now, this is a serious question. William Scott whose real name is Joe Finley, wrote an article for the follow-up about this records you need to keep for the IRS. And the IRS does allow you to become a professional investor in pari mutuel funds if you choose to be. So if you want to keep records for the IRS, and not what records, keep the records, keep all your records, if you're going to be pro. I admire this, it's very ambitious, and I hope to gosh that someday that you have to report $1 million. Okay, I've done that one. I've done that one. We're getting good here. I've done that one. Okay, Jimmy, somebody is nostalgic here. And they want to know what REITs on Zeromation are comparable to. I'll take one of them. Factor W, Factor X, and SBEP, all the things that they used to get on Phase 3. Factor W is who hits the third panel first. And I'll let Jimmy talk about the others.
There is a Factor X on the Ross IR, used to be on, I'm not sure it's on there now, I've changed these programs so many times, on Thermation. Early is your early paragon, or your early ranking. Sustained is your sustained paragon, or your sustained ranking. Factor W is your presser paragon, or your presser ranking. Late energy, or LX, is normally about the same as the third fraction. How the horse runs the third fraction would be similar to the old ultra scan late. Now, was any other, Howard?
They just want to know the nomenclature. They're all in there somewhere, but the object of Thermation is that you don't have to worry so much about the readouts. You're into an entirely different field of endeavor. You're getting into energy, you're getting into deceleration. So the Thermation readouts should be treated as himself and not try to relate them to something we did years ago. I don't consider that an unintelligent question for the simple reason that at Expo 93, Andy Beyer asked Tom and myself the same question. Whatever happened to that wonderful Factor W? That was great. Don't you have that anymore? He liked that. Okay, Jimmy and Tom doesn't like to answer these as much as Jimmy does. Thermation has three screens. Thermation, EXD, acceleration, and sustained phase. Like you do, this is the ghost of the heart of the matter. I thought we'd taken care of this last night with those races we ran through, but given some index, Jimmy has been looking on these screens. What would constitute a bad horse? They could just automatically look up and say, there's a bad horse.
Well, a low total energy in the very beginning would be a bad horse. A low total energy, that because he's going to be the one that says it needs to adjust. Now make sure he's a true contender, and that he says he's coming from another track, he's coming from an off track, he's coming from some type of surface change, and that if you don't have another line to use or the guidelines that Tom just showed you, look at other races to make sure that he's a real contender. If he makes no move whatsoever on Thermation, then he is probably a bad horse. And if he shows up number one on sustained, look at other readouts and see if he's a one-move horse. By a one-move horse, it says only one-third, maybe a third fraction only. Look at the fractional times on each of the screens. You know, there's more than one screen to look at. But one of the better things is to look at your racing paper before you put them in to see why you're putting a horse in. You know, is he high APV? Is he, what is he? Why do you want him? If you want him and you can't get him, do it to adjust. If you don't want him, take him out. So I would start looking at the total energy as the main thing, because the total energy is how the horse runs the race.
And another bad horse would be one that's constantly trying to sneak in with the broodmares. I have an add to that, and that is I occasionally meet a couple of guys out at Los Alamitos, and they're nice guys. They leave me alone, so I don't mind being out there with them, because normally I try to be on my own. I've been making a morning. It's one of the hard adjustments I've had to make myself, is to get away from the really short prime. You know, I've always depended on a sheer number of winners, and that just becomes, increasingly more dissatisfying for me. And so I've been trying, I've been making a line, and within the horses that I think have a really good chance of winning, I've been playing to the overlay on that line. Now, like I said the other night, that doesn't mean I go down and choose the fourth horse that may have no chance just because it's a prize. Well, both of these other people are the kinds of players that insist on putting everything in. Now, Jimmy says throw them out if they can't, if they don't measure up. And I'm the first one to tell you to do the same thing. Get rid of the horses that don't measure up, period. All you do is confuse the issue. And if you can't throw them out, then you become a better handicapper and then learn to throw them out. That's the solution to that. Now, my line, I'm often in a position of saying my top horse is going to be 2-1 in here. And what I'm doing is just kind of taking the rankings of the categories that I'm using and making a line based on how these horses compare to one another to that total line. So I may have one at 2-1, one at 5-2. Well, when you add 9 horses or 8 horses or whatever they're using out in their own particular line, you'll see this long list of horses where mine is that long. Now, the same horse I'm willing to take 2-1 on, they're often stuck with 5-1 on a legitimate 2-1 shot because they have so many horses nibbling at the probabilities in the race that there's no such thing as a 2-1 when you have 8 contenders and they're all taking bits and pieces of one another. So the legitimate 2-1, you're looking for 5-1. And I've seen these guys go up and take 15-1 on a horse that they have at 9-1 who has absolutely no prayer and should not have been left in, but of course that's the only odds they can get in there. The 5-1 shot that they insisted on wins at $7, so I get my overlay if it wins. All right, I'm going to lose or otherwise, but the point is that they're not able to bet that horse because of that. Learn to sort them out, get rid of the horses that don't belong. And that is as important a point as I can impart in here. Learn to do that. Learn to do the handicapping piece.
Well, back to the question, if you answer very fast about the Thoromation screen, the horse that comes up number one and usually number two on the Thoromation screen will be matched on one of the other screens. And that is called the matching screen. Contrary-wise, where it produces a different result from the first two in Thoromation, is called the opposite screen. If you want to get a down-dirty look, what the two adjustment would probably produce, you look at what is known as the opposite screen, which is a screen which does not match the running horse screen. And it mentions here, and it's a very cogent mention, is that we did not use the Thoromation screen in any of the readouts in this manual. We chose to use the stop action screen. Well, one of the reasons for that is we can't make a move across the paper here, so it doesn't have as much thrill to it. And secondly, we wanted to show you the viability of the new SPN in combination with the probability and odds line, so we focused on having all the races that we did show those as much as possible. And here's another cogent observation, and if you find this true as this person did, then it is true. And that is, if he gets a mishmash and he finds total confusion on all three screens, does that mean that it's a contentious race? I would say the answer to that, gentleman, would be yes. If he can't make sense of it, then it's a contentious race. I would say that on your dark days, study these kinds of races because they're going to probably give you a big payoff. And there's an answer to every problem, and that answer is achieved by your going over it time and time again and experiencing which readouts pointed to the winner and remembering them. Okay, this is a getting up into the Brohammer type of races, and Jimmy loves to play these races because he goes from track to track to play the big stakes races. If you got any guidelines for handicapping grade 1, 2, and 3 stakes races, what do you look for in those kinds of races, gentlemen, to get your contenders? That's Tony Hill. He gets a number one.
Yeah, what I'm going to suggest to you is that you buy Handicapper's Condition Book and/or Recreational Handicapping, both written by James Quinn, and take it that way, because this is something that we can talk about for the next hour, and you can get the same information by reading those books. It's very clear in there, and contrary to what Howard said, those are not my kinds of races. I like them. I will play them, but if my living had to depend on playing grade 1, grade 2 type races, I'll work in a liquor store again. Again, I never have, but I mean, I would work in a liquor store. I said that the other night, that's why I said it again. But nevertheless, if it depended on those kinds of races, that's what I would do. Those are not my bread and butter races. I like them, and I'll play them occasionally, but it's not mine.
I really love
because they're the ones that they simulcast in. And, you know, I get the opportunity to play something rather than just bad horses sometimes. I mean, they're really good races, and I love them. And just like I did the Molson Million, I like to find horses that are going to be just right there at the mile call, if it's a mile and a quarter, and find out just exactly where they are. I really, really use positions. These horses are more consistent. You know, they are really consistent on their past performance. If they get the lead, they want the lead. And if they can only win on the lead, and you can find out that they're not going to get it, you can get rid of them. If you can find out it's the wrong distance for them, by just looking at the past performance. I really dearly love these type races.
I don't look. I mean, I did. If it's a big race and it comes up, and I can find a horse that I get that everybody else hasn't selected, it isn't the favorite. Well, I love them, especially in 5 and 6 horse fields when you get these double digit mutuals. But I have no special way. I do everything the same. Quite honestly, I put them through the computer and play the ones that are supposed to win. So I don't have the kind of esoteric knowledge that either Tom or Jimmy have in these, or any particular technique. This is a good question because it's going to come up, especially in the summertime at a lot of your tracks. Arlington, Hollywood Park is probably coming up daily at Hollywood Park right now. And you got a 6-5 and an 8-5 going off should you pass the race.
My answer to that is always. I mean, I can't imagine not passing that if your horses are 6-5 and 8-5. There's absolutely no reason to play that race because the return is so small. If you miss it, you got the next 3 tries at that same price just to get your money back or more. So you can't play that. If you can't separate those two horses so that the 8-5 should be 6-5 in your own thinking, you bet it. Otherwise, but you cannot play both. You can't play both. You can't. There's just no return on that. You win one and you make a few dollars. You lose one and all of a sudden you're in the hole and you're 50%. You win the next one, now you're 2 out of 3, you're still in the hole. That doesn't make any sense.
Total agreement.
Yeah, I know what you do. You parlay 5 of them together and win them all 5 and get 10-1.
Yeah, I do that here in Vegas. Yeah, but not too hard.
No. There's a profit to be made in this race. If these are the kinds of races you're getting and these are the only kind you can win, you can make a profit by properly dusting them. I mean, if you want to take them, properly dust them. For instance, you can go a week in a row at Hollywood Park this summer when Tom, of course, was on vacation and didn't suffer these low mutuals. You could go a week in a row and these are the kind of odds you get. Oh, you get 2-1 once in a while. But these are the low kind of odds you get. David Berrios has a good suggestion for you. Take a look at the place prices in the results chart and see if you might make some more money in that. And also study how to get exacted. Sometimes these 6-5 and 8-5 horses keyed with a long playing place horse will get you a good exacted. There's money to be made in any race, and if these are the only kind you get, change your dutching from 70-30 or 80-40, or whatever. That doesn't play. 70-30 or 60-40, 75-25, something like that. If that's what you've got. Now, at Arlington Park, you had a little problem like that, didn't you, this last summer? This is what you got. And if you walk there and pay your money to get in, don't tell me. Now, Tom will. I've seen Tom just sit around there. And, well, of course, when people are asking for your autograph all day, you don't have to worry. But I've seen Tommy walks the infield, he won't play him, but very few people can pay their way to the parking lot, pay their way to the track, do all that work the night before, and not make some wagers. My suggestion would be learn how to pick place horses, look for show opportunities, learn how to win exactives, and parlay these low-priced horses into bigger profit.
I agree more. I mean, I'd be the last person to chastise you for playing, because in most cases, this is a hobby. In the vast majority of these cases, it's a hobby, and you don't get to do it every day. And I would find ways to play. I would find exactives. If you can stand a hit, you know, of losing those races more often than you win them. But I would find ways to play if it were still a hobby. I mean, in a minute. The only reason I take a lot of time off and I do walk the infield, I go out to the sun for a while, it's just because if I don't play well, now, the Dancing Bananas last night referred to me as a part-time player. Well, I do have another income. I think I've told everybody I have a small retirement income, so I have to supplement it. And I play full time from October to June, every day.
Now, if that's a part-time player, God knows what a full-timer is. But nevertheless, because of that, and because if I don't play well, the year doesn't go by for me. You know, I don't get by. So as a result, I have to be kind of careful, and I just don't play those. But if I were still a hobbyist, if I still worked for, I worked for Pacific Bell, I've been retired, I've been doing this for 6 years now, it's wonderful. I recommend it to anybody with the patience and the skills to be able to do it. I mean, it's just great. But 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I would go to the races and I would play because I couldn't go every day. And I certainly wouldn't chastise you for doing that.
I'd probably pass.
Yeah, right. You wouldn't pass anything.
You haven't passed a race since I've known you. Really, boy, you know. Jimmy will pay him a 1-5. But he'll parlay it with four other winners and he'll end up pretty good. When you play 27 races a day, folks, you don't mind having a few that don't make you a profit. Jimmy never knows whether he won the last race because he's all over the place in Vegas, and even when he's off playing two tracks in Hot Springs and three tracks sometimes, he never knows which race is running that he's in, so he never has the great thrill of winning one or the terrible pain of defeat until Leroy finds the right screen for him and tells him what happened. There's a good question here, and we're not making fun of this. We really aren't. It may sound like it, but I promise you. How do you tell a slow horse?
Usually I just go up and whisper in his ear, "You're slow."
That's how you tell it.
That's how you tell it. I mean, you've got to break the news to him sometime. How do you tell a slow horse? I'm not going to make fun of this, because sometimes you look at it, if you have a horse that runs 111-3 regularly and is competing against 110-2s, it's pretty safe to say that that's a slow horse. And that is the quickest way to get to that. What complicates that, and what might make that a legitimate question, and what does make it, is that there is such a thing as a slow racetrack. That's the reason I do my variant. So just make sure that the 111-3 you're looking at now has other races at the same 111-3 and can't run the 110-2, and then you have a slow horse. It's the only way I can answer that question.
Some of these specific questions we're not going to answer, such as sometimes my two winners come up 1-3 on one screen and 1-4 on the other screen, and they come up differently, and how do I handle it? You handle it by doing it from experience, by learning what your mistakes were. The only way you're going to learn how to use any readout, any set of readouts, is to understand what the readout is telling you to begin with, and then in determining how you can improve by getting the proper contenders. I just can't tell you, why does my program get the winner 1-3 and place horse 1-3 when you get it 1-2? It has to do with the horses and pace lines we're putting in. And the only way that any of us ever got it down to where we had the proper pace lines and the proper order of finish was by making all the mistakes that are represented by some of these questions. Any comment?
No, I want to add to what I said, and that is the right answer. It's instinctive. But it was not instinctive originally. And the only thing I would say to you, and Jimmy and I were just talking about that a little while ago, when we first started in this, I worked a race, and after it was over, I worked it again and again and again and again. And I was constantly buried in the racing form, working and reworking these races. And eventually, those things will they will become instinctive, unless you're just a non-learner. And I don't know anybody in here that fits that description. It will become instinctive. You will know when you look at it that this is a slow horse and does not belong in the mix of contenders at all.
Let me remind you of one other thing. And the state of my office proved his demonstration of this. God, if anybody ever lit a match in there. I've never seen a winning race, except when I do it myself or meet with Tom and Jimmy, because everybody sends me their problems. I got them packed up like this. You send me three consecutive losing races. I don't want to have one you lost on Thursday and one on next Tuesday and something. Three consecutive races that you lost, where the winner pays something over $9 and under 20. You know, don't give me a huge anomaly, but don't give me something that anybody could have won. Give me something that's reasonably difficult. Send me three losing races in a row with your readouts, your pace line selections clearly marked, and the results charts, and of course the past performances. I will then critique that race, send it back to you, and if it's as good as some of the doozies I get, it'll appear in the follow-up. That's what we're here for. If you want a quicker way of doing it, and it's not as effective, don't send Tom or Jimmy races. You can call Jimmy at his number, which he will not be answered unless Jimmy is home. And don't expect Jimmy to coddle you. But tell him the problem, and he'll give you a good answer. So we're here to help, but we do have a follow-up service for these specific questions. So we're coming down to the end of it. And how many of you have never used the follow-up service? Have never said you didn't want to bother us? If you don't bother us, what's the reason for our being? That's how we get our structure. We'll grant you we're masochists. Now, Tom used to do this, but he and Shirley, when they rekindled their romance, he said, I'll take calls on Wednesday night between 6 o'clock and 6:05, but please don't have anybody call. But he became famous. He doesn't do this anymore, but he does his share. He does his share at the track, because people recognize his handsome features and they go up to him. So he gets pretty busy at this. But any of these people, Bruce Jorgensen has been answering things, and he gets a little harsh up there. He has a few timid people who don't call him anymore. Vic Palermo gets people calling him from all over, and once they even moved in with him. He said, you got a spare bedroom? He moved in with Vic. That was carrying a little bit too far. And gosh, anybody you see, and Sam Wanna, my gosh, he's surrounded all the time. The silent one is not silent when two or three are gathered together in his name. All of these teachers are willing to help you anytime. So anytime these questions are not answered and you don't get it through your cognition, then you must practice. How many of you play the piano or guitar or whatever? Any guitar players here?
Well, this is a talented group.
Boy, that's wonderful. There's a banjo player over there. Tony's a banjo player. Huh? Pedal steel? Yeah. Don't we have any musicians in here? Hey, you know that kid? Oh, good. You're a winner. That's Al Morgan. You know something? You ought to all take music lessons. I'm serious. Music and handicapping are very, very similar. It's rhythm, folks. It's a rhythmic process. And speaking of that, we'll get to the last question here. The last question is pretty potent, and it has to do with form cycle. It is pretty well established that if you could detect a horse's exact form cycle, which nobody's ever been able to quite do, you could pinpoint exactly which pace line to use exactly for every horse and win at least 90% of all the races. Wouldn't that be true? So let's discuss form cycle, which is one of your great specialties, to the degree that it can be predicted.
Well, there's a little blurb in the racing form today. It's a letter to the editor regarding this customer instruction program that Quinn and I and Frank Romano did at Santa Anita. And it's very complimentary. It's very nice. And the fellow I worked with, Frank Romano, I spent a lot of time with form cycles, and he made me feel like a little kid. He's very good. And he just and he's very good because he does it himself, and he spends just all kinds of time on patterns. Patterns of horses, patterns of, you know, the form cycles as they come in, come out. He keeps back forms, and he just has this to his science. The problem with form cycles is that you not only have the horse, but you have the trainer of the horse, because it changes from time to time. So you look at a horse and say, well, this horse held his form for four races down here at the bottom of the past performances, and now here he is coming back into form, therefore he should do what he did down there. Except in the middle of that, he may have been claimed by another guy who might be a very good trainer, but will train him differently. Now you've got that to confuse you. The horses run differently at different ages. At two, they run readily. At three, they become a little more cantankerous, a little undependable, but they're still pretty sound. At four, now things begin to catch up. At five, if you look back and see what the horse did as a three-year-old, it may have no bearing today. All you can do is take a look and guess as to whether or not this horse is coming to form, staying in form, or declining in form. And the tools you've got are the positions, the running positions, and how close the horse is each race, what it's doing at various distances. The buyer numbers are good for this piece, because if they're declining on the horse, there's a good chance the horse is declining. They're not that far off. Or the speed ratings and bearing. But all you can do is take the horse right now, at this point in time, and make a guess. And if the guess is that the horse is improving, then you can be very flexible in your pace line selection. If the guess is that the horse is declining, then you better stay right here with the last pace line or very close to that, because it's going to go the wrong way. It's a very inexact science, and some people are really good, and this Frank is just outstanding at it. And I'm somewhere less than that, I guarantee you. But I study it a lot, and I try, but it is a big guess. And all you can do is do it over and over and over again until you recognize declining and ascending type horses, and then try to relate that to the age of the horse and the trainer and all the rest of those things. Not to the trainer's ability, but whether it's the same person that trained it when it got good before. I hope that answers it. I'm not sure on that one.
I have nothing to add to that at all. We focused a lot on this. Of course, how many of you have read Mark Kramer's Thoroughbred Cycles? That's a good book on form cycles. Every one of our computer programs has a form cycle detector in it. What you do is go through Tom's exercise here, where you enter a series of lines and see. You can use the pace of the race, pace of the horse. You can use the thoroughmation screen. You can use the stop action screens. See the horse's the progress of the horse through its entire history, like you did with Cumpleaños in the Yellow Manual. That is a form cycle detector. If you want a reminder of that, go back to reading the Yellow Manual and Cumpleaños. There are several follow-up issues which have form cycle detectors in it. And looking at the history of the horse, as Tom says, whether you look at it as he did visually, with positions, how it's coming up, look to see what pace it ran against, or you do it in a computer if you need it that way. That's the closest you come to form cycle detection.
And improving turn times are really a good sign.
Oh, yes.
Very good sign. Before, that was the last question, was it? Before we go on, one more. Before we get to that, I would just like to, I'd like to thank a couple of people in here, because it was a new addition, and I thought they did really well. One was David Barrios, who I'd like to hear more from next time.
Come to our meeting.
Does anybody agree with that? And the other's a good personal friend, and that's still going. So, you know, he's very good every time, and I'd like to hear more from him if he's saying. Sure you do, too, before I suggest it to Howard or
I want to tell you something, Tom. Each one of those guys that did a Beaumont session, which you normally did for your fee, and they got your fee for doing it. That's why you couldn't come. To all of them is, the only way you can have the answer to that is from your own experience. Run races through, and your experience will be the answer, because I cannot answer a question based on your handicapping when it comes to where a horse is supposed to be in the arena. How do you do ROI? How many people know precisely how to do ROI? Return on investment. That's not very many. Okay, everybody get out a pencil or something that writes. Let us say you just did 10 races. You bet $4 a race. Your total bet is $40. Let's say of those 10 races, you won 6. And your gross return was $60. Subtract the 40 that you bet from the 60. That leaves 20. I hope. Divide 20 by the 40 you bet. What is your ROI? 50%, right? Right? You put a 1 in front of it so you won't feel left out. If I only made 50%, you're thinking you didn't make what you bet. So you put a 1 in front of it. All that means is, whether you won or lost a race, you made a profit of 50 cents on every dollar you bet. That is your return on investment. And don't be confused by return on investment. Read the little section in this manual at your leisure. On page 85, it's a reprint from the Kramer-Olmsted report. And it's Mark Kramer's change, his metamorphosis from focus on ROI to his newest concept, which is, I agree with wholeheartedly, and which Tom Brohammer does, because Tom makes more per hour than the guy, the friend of his, who has supposedly a higher ROI. It's how much you make an hour. What's your time worth an hour? More important than ROI. If you can bet one bet a week and have a 100% ROI, but still not pay the rent.
The other way, if you have your data, your betting records in front of you, your data rather than total amounts, it's just win percentage times average mutual. So if you're 30% winner and you get $7, that's $2.10 for every $2 you bet, or a nickel on the dollar. That's the other way, if you have that data in front of you.
Well, that will end our formal session with this afternoon. You know who they are. All of our people will be very willing to help you. Jimmy has done this with this young gentleman here already. We didn't do over any specific races because we know you're from various parts of the country. You bought your forms that you want. But anybody who wants to help you, we'll be very happy to do so. And the last formal statement I want to make to you all is to tell you how much we appreciate your coming, and especially from my own heart, how much I appreciate your loyalty in light of the fiasco of last night. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.